This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. William Heath is with us, and he is an author of 3 books of poetry, 2 chapbooks of poetry, 3 novels, historical work, and more. But we're going to start with a poem. Here's William Heath.
This poem is set in about 1950, so I'm a boy about 8 or 9. The Korean War is going on. And as a kid, I think war is neat. And so my friends and I go to the Army Surplus Store and buy up on war equipment and play war games, in effect. But the poem is about a transition in my life. And it's titled, How I Left the War and Took Up Basketball. The first time he whipped a behind-the-back pass to the open man on his blind side, Bob Cousy knew he was a star. A small man with big hands, quick as a poet, his pinpoint passes scored baskets. Me, I practiced down in our pitch-black cement cellar, dribbling with either hand in the dark. Sometimes I sat with my eyes shut, spinning the ball on my fingers, rubbing the nubbles and whispering to myself. This was near the end of the Ohio phase of the Korean War, when coming home at dusk from the Battle of Hidden Valley and Lee Run Creek, I ran headfirst into a barbed wire fence, slicing my skin at the hairline. My mother screamed to see the web of blood while I searched my skull in the mirror, praying for a scar. At first, I shot from the hip, pushing off on my left leg to launch a giant step up with my right, banking the ball off the board to drop through the hoop. By junior high, I had a fallaway jump shot and basketballs on the brain.
Praying for a scar, anything to be a hero,
that's
right?
That's right. Yeah, that's a kid, isn't it?
Yes. Now, that poem is from what book?
This is a book called Steel Valley Elegy, and the opening series of poems, which I read one from, is about growing up just outside Youngstown. I was born in Youngstown, and at that time, Youngstown was a thriving steel town.
Mm-hmm.
And because it was so thriving, the mafia saw it as an ideal spot to fight. The Cleveland Mafia and the Pittsburgh Mafia wanted to control the bug. So when I was growing up, there were 85 gangland bombings in Youngstown, at least a dozen people killed. And so that was another dimension of my life. I never saw any of the violence myself. My father was a junior high principal in Youngstown, and so he was down there in the middle of it. But that lasted well into the 60s, and it was called the Little Chicago.
And then you went from the 60s to protesting and being sprayed with all kinds of mace. And you just went from one turmoil to another.
That's right. The second sequence has a lot of poems about the 60s, in fact.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll read at least one of those later on.
I hope so. You know, your books are very consistent. And your voice is on the page so that I would know it anywhere I saw it without your name. I think there is a regularity and a rhythm and a flow that comes from you, and we call this having a voice.
Mm-hmm.
How do you describe your consistency and your methodology?
Well, it's true that I think it's very important for a poet to have a voice. The opening poem that's longer, called Steel Valley Elegy, the title poem, opens with the line, I speak Steel Valley American.
Mm.
And so I try to develop a kind of idiom that is my own. And so I'm very pleased that you find my voice recognizable, because that's something I really have strived from the very beginning to do.
And your topics are really American history.
Definitely in Steel Valley Elegy, the other book that we'll come to later is all set in Europe,
mm-hmm.
and other parts of the world. But I do write poems about historical events. I was a history major in college, an American studies major in graduate school. And my novels and poems both combine, I think, an interest in history and literature.
I was a failed history major myself, but I went soaring into literature. Let's hear 2 poems from this book. And if you'll set them up for us, please.
Okay. I'm going to read another from those early autobiographical poems, and this is called An Inside Job, and it's a true story. I worked in the summers to pay for my college tuition. I think that the days when you could do that and didn't run into debt. But this is a true story, and of course, this mafia background I've mentioned is sort of in the background, although not in the forefront. For 3 summers, I sell bait, boats, fishing permits at Evans Lake to those lunatics who show up before dawn to hook their fill of perch, bass, and bluegills. An old black man likes to gig for carp along the shoreline. Most men want to be out on the water, fine with me. I am free to read a good book by lunch when the fishermen dock drive off with their catch. One morning I am late as usual. Cars are lined up. Men stand hands on hips, scowling as I unlock the gate. But the back door is open, so is the safe. Someone, during the night, has robbed the boathouse. The detective, decked out in a TV trench coat, asks a few questions, paces back and forth, catches my eye. Looks like an inside job. A lie detector will tell. Headquarters in Youngstown, where the usual suspects are wise guys implicated in gangland bombings. I sit in a third floor room below a bare bulb, a strap across my chest, fingers attached. The questioning begins. Yes or no, my options. I affirm my name, address, deny I robbed the safe or know about the theft. At the end, a dim smile for my inquisitor. I ask how I'd done. Not very good, Bill. And he shows me the zigzagging printout proclaiming my guilt. Either you did this or you know who did, I am told. We have your address. You'll be hearing from us. For weeks, I rarely slept. The crime remains unsolved. All these years, I ponder why my doorbell never rang. The city cops are swamped or snug in the mob's pocket. No bombers stand trial. Why did I fail the test? When Keats saw a sparrow pecking the gravel, he became that bird, felt its satisfaction. A crowbar for the door, sensitive fingers cracked the safe, loot crammed in a bag. I made a clean getaway. In my defense, I plead poetry.
Oh, how old were you?
I was a college student. That's how I paid for college. So I was 18, 19... 20, somewhere in there.
But why did you fail the test?
Well, as I try to imply there, I think my poetic empathy was such I could picture doing the job.
Of course. And do you know the terror?
Yeah.
That one, I would imagine that my heart rate would go up. And
well, exactly.
There's no way you can
and
pass.
And I'm fairly high strung. And so, you know, that's exactly what happened. But
and I can imagine you're tossing and turning for days
boy.
After
yeah,
that.
Yeah, no, that was agonizing.
Yeah. And in the midst of all that mafia activity, they
that's
had
right.
to put you on the griddle.
Yeah. Now, going down there, where you know, that was a grim place because, you know, the police were also in the mafia's pocket more often than not. So you didn't know what was going to happen to you when you went down to that place.
Read on. Read
okay.
on.
We talked about poems about the 60s. So I think I'll read another poem. That's set in the 60s. I read this at the Mount St. Mary's last year, and some of the students didn't know who Dylan was. Anyway, this poem is called Dylan. A sharp-featured, skinny angel with a frizzy halo of reddish-brown curly hair, tousled like a fright wig, brambled in tangles and knotted by the wind, wearing a snap-brim corduroy Huck Finn cap, blue jeans, brown jacket, his head bent to the lost ghost wail of a sad harmonica, an acoustic guitar strapped over his shoulder, scraps of songs crumpled up in his pockets, a scruffy runt defiantly slinging street words into poem songs, put-downs, and prophecies. Exalted on high-heeled, hand-tooled, battered desert boots, this sunken-eyed seer back from a badlands death trip looks into the dark like a night hawk. With grim wit, he whines, his rhyme visions, the poetry of apocalypse.
Your students did not know.
Right. Didn't know who
Do
I
they
was
know who Dylan
to.
Thomas is?
Well, probably, I'm almost sure not.
You know, isn't that always startling to you?
Right.
That they think the Vietnam War and the Boer War were the same
year?
Oh,
yeah. No, it's amazing when you get into all that.
But
yeah.
Isn't that a little frightening?
It is indeed.
Because
yeah.
when we were young, we studied history.
Right.
We had to know
That's
history.
Right, yeah.
Is it just lacking in our curriculum?
Well, you know, I think history is badly taught. There's all this pressure now not to teach the truth about history. There's all the media stuff, et cetera, that just is incredibly distracting. And people think they can go on the internet and get all the information they need, and really they can't. I mean,
but now they have robots who can do it for
that's
them.
Right. Yeah,
it's better than a cliff note.
No, it's very grim. It's very depressing.
I think we have to keep writing poetry, keep publishing poetry.
That's right.
That's terrific. This was Steel Valley Elegy.
Right.
And is the elegy a significant word?
Well, I think so, because again, the title poem sort of celebrates the lost brutal beauty, as I say, of the Steel Valley. So that's a world that's gone now. It really is.
There are no steel mills.
They're all gone. I mean, not even the skeletons of the buildings.
Pittsburgh as well, I think.
And Pittsburgh, of course, has made this remarkable recovery, and Cleveland is trying hard. But Youngstown's been a slump ever since.
Wow.
The downtown looks presentable now, but there's nobody there. There's nobody downtown.
But we have a book. A book that will remain forever as a memorial.
Yeah, I'd like to think so. Thank you.
It's what we do.
That's right.
Well, let's hear some more from a different book. And this is your peripatetic self who has roamed the world. You know, there is an epigraph in the beginning that I wish you would read and I wish you would talk about.
Okay. Yeah, I don't remember where I came across this, but it struck me as very interesting and fitting. The man who finds his country sweet is only a raw beginner. The man for whom each country is as his own is already strong. But only the man for whom the whole world is a foreign country is perfect. And it's from someone called Hugh of St. Victor of the 12th century.
What do you think that means?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it has to do, I think, with the more you travel, the more you gain a kind of wisdom that also teaches you everything you don't know and how mysterious everything is.
And that actually comes to mind today when white nationalism equals ignorance.
Exactly. And that's why, you know, I'm glad to have a whole book of poems set abroad, because we're so self-centered in this country. We know so little about the rest of the world. And I was a Fulbright for 2 years in Spain. And so the first half of the book is based on Spain, both Andalusia and Catalonia. And then the book goes through Europe, and then it goes, in effect, around the world. So it's really about getting to know the world.
Well, what was your Fulbright focused on?
Well, I was there to teach American literature to Spanish students. It wasn't a research Fulbright, it was a teaching Fulbright. And so my job was to be the American voice.
Were they English-speaking students?
Yeah, they were Spanish-English majors. Mm. And so they were studying American literature, and I taught them American literature.
Fascinating.
And, so yeah.
And we got a great book out of this, so give us a taste of it.
Okay. Well,
William Heath is his name, and the book is Going Places.
So the first couple of poems I'm going to read are set in Andalusia, and I was the Fulbright in Sevilla, as they say there. And that's an incredibly beautiful city, probably the most beautiful in Spain. And it has an amazing history and culture, et cetera. And I hope these poems are more than just a tourist visiting, because I was there for 2 years, and I sort of got to know the place more or less from the inside. I'm not fluent in Spanish, so that limits how inside my knowledge is. But I certainly spent a lot of time in the streets. So this poem is called Our Lady of Flamenco. I hear talk about flamenco, how the woman knows when to lift her skirt, how to let her hands come alive in the air, fingers spiraling and snapping, uplifted arms swaying slowly, a woman maybe in her 40s, full-breasted, wide-hipped, dancing with two men half her age, and filling them with a foot-stamping desire everyone in the audience can feel, while the hands smack out an intricate rhythm, clapping faster and louder than any music mere hands could make, yet did, filling the whole room with it, until all were drawn to their feet to be dancers too, fingers snapping, feet beating on the floor, an insistent lust for life itself. All this one woman, with swirling skirts, sure steps, and head held as high as pride and passion would allow, all this one woman accomplished by mastering the voluptuous movements of her turning, unfurling, duende dance. Now, duende is a word people don't know. It's an untranslatable word, but it's very, very important in Spain. And the closest I come, it's sort of doing something splendidly with great soul, you know. And it's basketball players talk about being in the zone, that kind of thing. It has a really deep meaning in Spain, in other words.
Oh, that's so interesting. Well, details are your friend.
That's
details
right.
are your friend. They are your muses,
yeah.
because we are there with you. We are with every poem. We are right there with you.
Yeah, that's something, you know, I think I learned from other poets like William Carlos Williams, is to ground your poems in specific images, to write about what's out there. Walt Stevens said the greatest poverty is not to live in a physical world. And I think poetry has to put you in a physical world in a very detailed, precise way.
But he is very puzzling in a way.
He doesn't always do it himself, I must say. But I like that particular quote. I mean, he goes very abstractly into philosophy, et cetera. So,
but he has ice cream and he has different
right.
things we can notice.
That's right.
Let's have another poem from
okay.
Going Places.
Again,
William Heath.
We're on the streets of Seville. I lived in the Barrio de Santa Cruz, which is the old Jewish quarter, and it's in the very center of Seville, just off the street from the famous cathedral. And it's all winding streets. You can't get cars back there and so forth. So it really is sort of the heart of Seville. So it's called Barrio de Santa Cruz. In Spain, the rain falls mainly in the mountains, and the pain is on display in the streets. Like any Ohio boy, the first time a gypsy holds out her hand, I shake it. Watch your wallet, I learn. Never look a beggar in the eye. The mother gives her child a cardboard sign, Soy una pobre niña, shows how to expose one bare foot beneath a shawl full of holes, slaps her to make her cry. The child is quick to sort, to toss coins, gathering the larger ones out of sight, then resuming the lost look her mother taught her works best.
Mm, mm.
But today she is shivering in the cold, a more effective look her skin will not forget, nor her freezing bones, when she is a woman grown, teaching her poor daughter how to beg in the street.
You know, I haven't seen a poem like that, and it certainly should be written in Florence. The mothers with their drugged babies
yeah.
sleeping in their arms.
Right.
And I did give them money.
Sure.
Because,
it's hard not to.
But it is. And we did get our wallets yeah. fleeced.
Right.
In Florence.
Now, there is, you know, I don't like to talk in stereotypes, but there definitely is a gypsy culture that is based around begging. And it has been for centuries. And so if you have a bad day begging, you beg harder the next day. And if you have a good day begging works, you know. I mean, and then you pass that on. Obviously, not all gypsies are into that culture, but there is a subculture in the gypsy world that's based on begging.
Yes, it's heartbreaking.
Yeah.
And I don't think Europe is capable of fixing that social structure.
Right.
So
it's centuries,
every year
centuries
I go back
old.
And I see
yeah.
it. I do.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, let us talk a little bit about your teaching, because you've taught in 5 universities.
Right.
And you're an emeritus now.
Right.
But what did you hope you were doing? What do you think you achieved teaching American literature and creative writing? What are we all doing?
Well, I started out as a young instructor at Kenyon, and of course, it was famous for the Kenyon Review. I lived in the old John Crow Ransom house. Robert Lowell and Randall Jarrell lived in our living room and bedroom, respectively, at the time. And I went to Ransom's 80th birthday party, where I met Kenyon has just an incredible number of famous writers who've been there. And I met most of them who came to the party, Robert Lowell and et cetera. And that's really the first time I thought, I think I'll become a poet rather than a history teacher. And so I got involved in the poetry scene there. Paul Blackburn and Toby Olson, 2 New York poets, came and encouraged me to continue. So Kenyon played a key role, and that was my first job, deciding I should try to be a poet. And then at Transylvania, I really found Lexington an incredibly inspiring place for a poet. And so I wrote a lot of poems set in Lexington. And then I went on to Kenyon, or to Vassar College, and got to know another set of poets. Back when Billy Collins and Carolyn Forché and others were starting out. We were all the same age and got to know each other there at Kenyon, or I'm sorry, at Vassar. And so I made some good friends there who were into the literary scene, and I was still writing and publishing poems. Unfortunately, writing poems doesn't get you tenure, I found.
I don't know any poet who can write without teaching.
Yeah, and that was the catch. So I got that's when I got my Fulbright scholarship, when I didn't get tenure finally at Vassar. And I did win that same year. I didn't get tenure, a $4,000 grant from New York State. And then I got to Fulbright, so there's a happy ending attached to what was seemed to me quite a tragedy at the time. And then actually, because I hadn't gotten tenure, when I went to Spain, I switched my interest over to writing fiction and literary criticism. And so when I came back from Spain, I had a job at Mount St. Mary's. And for the next decade or two, at least, I published a lot of scholarly essays, and I published some novels. And of course, that got me tenure.
How did you approach creative writing when you walked into the class?
Well, I taught an introductory creative writing class that was both poetry and fiction. And so we split it in half, and I did half on poetry and half on fiction.
But did you use poetry as an apprenticeship, or did you try to inspire them to find their own source?
Well, we had a few things to read, but definitely I expected them to start writing poetry right from the start. It wasn't a sort of poetry appreciation. It was give me something on the page and I can work with it. And I think I got to be pretty good at that.
What do you think your students might remember about you?
Well, I don't know. You know, a few students to keep in touch. In fact, one of my best creative writing students in fiction has replaced me at Mount St. Mary's and also replaced me at Lighted Corners, our literary magazine that won national awards pretty consistently. And he's done an even better job, as they always win.
Let's hear another poem from Spain or Europe.
Yeah, let's go to Catalonia now. Those were two from Andalusia. And this is a poem set in Barcelona. And it's one of my favorite spots in Barcelona. And it's for Paul Blackburn, who encouraged me to go to Barcelona. He died very young in 1971. And it's based on a poem he wrote about Barcelona. The palm trees are still there, Paul. People of all ages pack the stone benches by the fountain and in the evening stroll across the square under the spiky, vaguely threatening wrought iron street lamps designed by a young Gaudí. Couples still carry babies in their arms, and long-legged women of the kind you kept your eye on are often seen nowadays from all parts of the world. Plaza Real is an enclosed surprise at the heart of the old city, an arcaded square accessed by alleys adjacent to the Rambla. Its high-shuttered apartments on all sides contain a Parisian flavor. Like Washington Square in the 70s, it was once the den of drug dealers, prostitutes, pickpockets, and purse snatchers. A seedy ambience adds spice to its charm. But now the word is Barcelona Paset Guapa, and the facades are freshly restored. It's no secret from the tourist hordes, tables from many cafes fill the arcades and spread into the square. Your favorite bar, the Glorieta, is long gone, Paul, along with the organized waddle of the waiter you evoked in the touch, who remembered you after many years, tapped your shoulder. When he died, you realized you never knew his name, and that we don't need to know people's names to love them.
Nice ending. Really nice. Why would a poet want to write a novel?
Well,
what obsessed you that you had to do that?
I mean, it was something I don't recommend. But as a poet, I mean, the reason I did it, I don't recommend. As a poet, I got into a frame of mind where I wanted each poem to be better than the last. And as you know, that's a bad idea, that your poems don't consistently keep getting better. You know, you write good poems and better poems and then not so good poems, but you have to stay with it. But I wanted to get better all the time. And I also felt that I couldn't fully express sort of my verbal gifts, if you can call it that, in poetry. So I switched over to writing fiction.
What gave you the idea of writing the novel? The first novel?
Well, the first novel, Actually,
is the children Bob Moses?
The first novel is actually published as my third novel, and it's called Devil Dancer. And it's a novel set in Lexington, and it was very much based on some of my experiences there. And I'd actually projected a trilogy of novels about Lexington, and this was only going to be the first one. Devil Dancer is a racehorse who is shot, and my detective, who's a kind of loser in several ways, he's just recently become a detective, and he's a very human guy. He's in a divorce, and it's left him very vulnerable and fragile. So he's sort of the opposite of the tough guy detective. Mm. And it enables him to explore Lexington in great detail, from the very wealthy horse farms to the world of pickpockets and criminals.
Is I have it a mystery? Pickpocket.
Yeah, he has to figure out who shot Devil Dancer.
Do you plot that out so that you know the ending?
No, actually, the ending changed over time. I mean, I roughly knew, but the actual way it ended, I originally wasn't going to solve the case. I was trying to write a kind of anti-crime novel. But finally, I decided I should solve the case. And so that's how the ending changed quite a bit.
But what did you learn? I mean, isn't writing a mystery novel like you get something happening and then you throw a monkey wrench in it and then you go on? Is that how you do it?
Well, in a way, I mean, I thought of it as a series of vignettes. You know, each chapter is one of the things that's good about a detective is he has an excuse to go visit everybody. And so you open a door and you've got another person in another world. And so I saw each of those as a kind of challenge of how do I make this person he's simply meeting for the first time come alive and be different from other people. Mm. And, you know, we mentioned voice in poetry, but voice in characters is very important to me, too. I want to make sure my characters don't all sound the same.
Absolutely.
And so that was much of the challenge. Fiction is made up of description, dialogue, and drama, I think, those three D's. And so I put a lot of attention on all three of those.
Let's hear some detail from Going Places.
Okay. This is a poem dedicated to my wife, Rosé, who I met, of course, as I was a Fulbright. I was in Seville. She was in the University of Barcelona. And we met at Santiago de Compostela. So in terms of the map of Spain, it's like I was in Austin and she was in Boston and we met in San Francisco. So it was meant to be, I guess. So this is one of my more lyric poems, I think. Rosé, all I do is reach across the table and touch your cheek to make you smile. And if I put my right arm around your waist, your left circles mine. This is called falling in love. Pressed lips in dark corners and the promise of more. Maybe a shared place in the summer, a quaint pueblo, flowered balconies, whitewashed walls, nearby mountains, and an easy walk to the sea.
Beautiful, beautiful. Mm. And she is beautiful, too.
She is.
I have another question about
right.
your history, book
That's
of history, right. which won three awards.
Right.
And what kind of research did that take?
Well, prodigious. I mean, also my novel about the civil rights movement, The Children Bob Moses Led, I spent about 10 years researching that. And then I originally wrote a novel about William Wells, this frontiersman who was captured by the Indians and then switched sides back. And his life sort of captures everything that matters north of the Ohio River from 1780 to 1812. He's everywhere where it counts, and he's playing a not insignificant role, but he's largely forgotten, as is, unfortunately, Bob Moses, this great leader of the civil rights movement. Anyway, I first wrote the novel, and my agent said, you put 10 years of research into this. Why don't you write a history book?
Mm.
And I said, well, I don't like to repeat myself. And she said, still, you know, there's all this stuff. And so I wrote it as a history book. And when I wrote the novel, I had visited 33 archives, including this Library of Congress, where we are now. But when I came to rewrite it, most of the sources I had to revisit were now available online. So I didn't have to travel back and forth across the country forever. Anyway, it was picked up very quickly by the University of Oklahoma, who probably are the best press in the country for Native American books. And it was very well received. It won two Spur Awards for a Best History Book of the Year and Best First Nonfiction Book of the Year. And then just recently, it's won another award for the best military history of the Ohio-related stuff.
And that award is called the Oliver Hazard Perry Award?
That's right. He's a famous person from the War of 1812. He was the Navy captain who defeated the British on Lake Erie.
I have to get you in touch with a friend of mine who's writing yet one more book about the War of 1812, okay. But it's 900 pages and he can't seem to stop.
Well, William Wells, I mean, actually dies at the start of the War of 1812. He had gone out to Fort Dearborn, present-day Chicago, to rescue the beleaguered garrison there surrounded by Potawatomi. And he tried to negotiate a truce so that they could evacuate the fort. And they thought they had a deal. The 95 people walked out of the fort, including Wells. And the Potawatomi ambushed them about a mile from the fort and killed about two-thirds of them on the spot, including Wells, who notoriously had his heart cut out and shared among the warriors because he was known for his bravery.
Well, this is one I'm going to look up, you can be sure. And we will now have a final poem.
Okay, this is one more. This poem is called Travel, and it casts a bit of an ironic and sardonic angle toward it, but I love travel. Travel is the saddest pleasure in the world, moving at whim through places we will never return to, faces we will never see again, and words we do not understand. We travel to say we have traveled, and as we go, we squint one eye, close the other, and hold between us the thing we have come to see, and a contraption out of Plato's cave, complete with its flash and fire, so that when we return to the place we left from and throw on the living room wall the shadows of where we might have been, we say, look, that's me with the Parthenon on my shoulders. And look, that's me again holding up that leaning tower with one hand.
Wonderful. William Heath is the recipient of the Hiram College Lifetime Achievement Award. And from the studios of the Library of Congress, this is The Poet and the Poem. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions, post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the library for making the program possible. Funding is provided by the Maryland State Arts Council, the Sinipet Fund, the Rivada Foundation of the Logan Family, Sandy Jackson Cohen, and Natalie Canavore. Mike Turpin is our engineer, and I'm Grace Cavalieri.